Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. We have an awesome show for you today. We're going to talk about the all-new Honda Pilot and what it's like to maybe get a little rough and muddy and ready off-road. So with that, I will bring in Associate Editor Byron Hurd. How are you?
Hey, doing pretty well. How about yourself?
Not bad. It is freezing. So, you know, we're at that point of winter. I think the last time I had you on the show, we're both kind of musing about how it felt more like late March. Well, now it feels like the first day of February. No doubt about it.
Yeah, we're definitely here. And it's, you know, we're talking about where we've been, what we've been doing. The pilot drive was out in Sedona where we got, I don't know, 3-4 inches of snow on our wave, which is very unusual there to the point where it paralyzed pretty much the entire trip. Like you get, you know, all these people like lined up and ready to go. And they're like, oh, can we go? Can we even get down the mountain? Like, are we going to be able to get around the local traffic? Nobody has snow tires here because it doesn't snow. And there are two roads that go anywhere. Meanwhile, I come back to Michigan, we get 10 inches of snow. And it's like, maybe they'll plow today. Maybe they won't. Eh, we'll see.
Yeah, no, that's a little bit of a different experience. That's for sure. And it is cold. Let's put it that way. It is.
Yes.
My phone just went from 20 and now it says it's 9 degrees. I feel like it's so cold that Google doesn't really know what the temperature exactly is. 9 degrees is cold. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
But so we'll talk about the Pilot, talk a little bit about the long-term 330e that I've been driving. I think I'm going to swap that car out in the next couple of weeks. So podcast listeners, I'll have something else to talk about pretty soon. And also some big news this week. The Mazda CX-90 was revealed. It is really, that's really quite an attractive looking large crossover. We'll have to talk about that. And then reports say the Genesis X is going into production. We will spend your money with one that I think is pretty well suited for you, Byron, given your sports sedan leanings. I think I know it could be on some of the short lists. So,
yeah.
And it actually works out for me too. As a Charger owner, you know, I have some ideas too. So,
yeah.
So that's coming up. Let's jump right in. The Honda Pilot, Arizona. You got to go off-roading. What did you think?
Well, it was honestly a very off-road heavy trip. And that's kind of surprising. You think of something like the Pilot, which is very much a like street-friendly family crossover, pretty much like the definition of a soft roader or a mall crawler. Like it is not the first SUV that's going to come to anybody's mind when you talk about off-road prowess. And it's interesting that Honda's kind of taken this hard lean toward the trail sports where, you know, everybody's doing something kind of off-roady, whether you've got, it's the Toyota's got the adventure models and Mazda has these Meridian models, like all this, it's, everyone's trying to do something that says, this isn't just a on-road comfy cruiser, a minivan without sliding doors. Like this is an actual SUV, even if it's unibody, it can do things. And I mean, sure, it made sense for Honda to jump into, but they seem to be taking it a little bit more seriously than everybody else, but at the same time pretending they're not taking it more seriously than anybody else. So they're doing a really good job of kind of managing expectations with this, especially because we get to the trip. Normally with these things, if you're doing an off-road course, it's either been built by the manufacturer or it's been heavily groomed by the manufacturer, or in some cases, it's not even an actual off-road course. It's just some things that have been purchased that you can, you know, drive over with whatever vehicle you're there to sample. But this time, it was very much like, here's the trail. That's where we're going. You can kind of watch our engineers drive up. And if you don't feel like it, you don't have to. And then just, you know, kind of point the car in the right direction and go. And normally on these trips, if you're doing off-road, you're basically not allowed to breathe without being told how deeply, you know, it's very well curated, very aggressively guided. And in this case, it wasn't at all. Honda was just kind of like, we know it can do it. Go out there, get to the top, see what there is to see. Come on back down. Let us know what you thought. And that's exactly what we did. It was one of the trails, I believe it was called Broken Arrow Trail. And it's used by the Pink Jeep Tours. So there were a lot of these huge, like they're factory chassis, but with a few modifications. But the Jeep builds them for these guys. They're nothing like crazy custom. Like they're fairly stock Wranglers with a big old basket on the back for hauling people who have had too much wine. And it was us, them, and a couple people in Land Cruisers up at the top of the trail. So that should give you an idea of kind of like, you know, who's going to venture off on these paths without guidance, right? And So even up at the top, you know, we're thinking, you know, we spent a lot of time going up this trail on the skid plates. We spent a lot of time bouncing and doing our best not to pinstripe the paint on the foliage and stuff. Like it was a route you actually had to think about. It wasn't automatic. And it really impressed me that Honda was so confident in the Pilot that they would just let us do it fairly freeform. Because even on a Jeep program, you're not getting that. Jeep is telling you where to put that wheel, where to put that. Like it's very regimented. And Honda was just like, yeah, it can do it. Go see for yourself. So I came away from this a lot more impressed than I normally am by these off-road things, because, you know, clearly Toyota and Mazda and everybody is trying to get into this same kind of basket. But I don't think I would have the confidence in those vehicles, even knowing that most crossovers are really more capable than we give them credit for. I don't think I'd come up to that very first check obstacle and just go, oh yeah, my Highlander is going to get me up this trail, no problem. I would take pause. And if I had been driving a Pilot on my own before I did this program and encountered that same obstacle, I probably would have turned around. So it was very revealing of the capability of these trucks. And especially now with, you know, we used to really shun like anything brake based, like, oh, if it's not a real locking or limited slip differential, it's not worth it. You know, it don't bother. You need a real locker. You need, you know. And honestly, you just don't anymore. Like the computer controls are getting so advanced to the point where the capability far exceeds expectations. And so Honda's got kind of these real kind of like secret rock stars in these trail sports, because they're the most rewarding to drive, even off-road or even on-road. I apologize. Like it's the torque vectoring all-wheel drive is excellent. There's a lot of like there's a lot more feedback in the steering wheel than you'd expect from just like a big soft cruiser. Like it's actually a vehicle that you can kind of toss around, and because it's a little more like off-road rough and ready, you feel what it's doing a little bit better. There's a little more feedback, and it's just like that kind of refinement that they backed off on just a little bit allows a lot more to come through, which of course is something we talk about all the time. It's like, you know, the more advanced, the more isolated these drive experiences get in every car, the less feel you have for what's going on around you. And the trail sports actually genuinely dial that back enough that I can't believe I'm saying this, but they're really fun to drive almost all the time, which, you know, like that's never going to be a bullet point you see on Honda Pilot. Like, yeah, this is fun to drive. I mean, fun to drive for a three-row crossover. Sure. That's one thing. But when you actually drive in, you're just like, hey, you know, this really just isn't a miserable way to get around. And I came away really impressed by it. And it's, you know, the manners on road are still good. And Honda's come a long way on fixing things like road noise and wind noise. Bad pavement's bad pavement. And tires are tires. I mean, that's one of those things you can probably fix if you find yourself still like kind of short of what you expected, because you know, spend a little extra on some good rubber the first time your tires are due up, and that can solve a lot of problems for you. But it's amazing how far they've come in just a few years, from being like it's a Honda, they can survive on their name, to that's actually an interesting vehicle over there and you should check it out. So needless to say, it was quite a trip.
It's interesting because you obviously would assume the lion's share of the Pilot lineup would not necessarily be people opting for the trail sport model. You know, the elite is, you know, elite, if you will. And it seems like they, you know, it's just not the type of vehicle where, you know, I think buyers really need that type of capability. But we're seeing it more and more with like the Pathfinder Rock Creek. You know, granted, Pathfinder is one that does have a bit of more of a heritage than, say, the Pilot does when it comes to going off-roading. But I also think it was probably a stroke of good luck for them. You know, as we talk a little bit like sort of behind the scenes at like what these press events are, they're almost like canned off the shelf adventures. You know, I looked at the pictures. It looks like you had a hell of a time. You know, this is like quite the adventure, maybe even more than they expected for the Honda Pilot drive. Like they kind of thought, hey, it's going to be a little gnarly, but not too bad. And then boom, you know, it's like snow in Arizona, even at that altitude is like, whoa, okay.
Yeah. And Honda even said like multiple times, like they were very much on message that the Pilot Trail Sport is not supposed to be an off-road model. It is a Pilot. It is an on-road vehicle. The Trail Sport is just there for the person who wants that extra reassurance that should they perhaps get in a little bit too deep, they can probably make it through. It's a little bit of built-in insurance. You're buying it mostly for the looks. You're buying it more for the attitude. It's not, you know, well, I can do this and go chase Grand Cherokees. You can't. That's just not happening. But it's still a pretty nice compromise, especially for people who just, you know, you occasionally get someplace where things can get a little dicey. You like going to parks where the trails aren't always reliable, like things like that. It's a slight insurance premium, essentially, that you're paying up front for trail sport to know that in that weird corner case, you probably won't have to call someone for help.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And, you know, again, like the Kia Telluride, the X Pro, things like that. I mean, they all offer a variety of like, hey, if you want to go off road, we give you some of the tires, you know, some of the looks, and they can do more than you think they might, frankly. You know, and the Pilot itself, you know, is an important vehicle for Honda, obviously. You know, the engine, I know, I liked how you wrote it, the dual overhead cam engine. Sounds the same, but it is actually a bit different. The interior, the exterior are a bit different. And this is just a huge volume play for them. I mean, it's hugely important when you look at like all the different, you know, crossovers and SUVs that they make. I'm curious, given like just how competitive this segment is. And I think I know where I would tend to fall, but how do you rate this? Where is it? Is it at the top of the heap? Is it in the middle of the pack? You know, where are you putting it these days?
It's going to be up there for me, honestly. Okay. And that wouldn't have been true of the last generation. But then, I mean, really, we've seen a lot of like changeover in three-row crossovers just over the last couple of years, because Highlander's not that old at this point. Pilot's brand new. Pathfinder's effectively brand new. It's, you know, a year and a half, 2 years old. And the Pathfinder, I mean, it had a long way to go going from the last gen to the current gen. So really anything they offered was going to be a huge improvement, but they really did take it seriously. And it's interesting. It's like the Pathfinder, I think, is probably the best direct competitor to the Pilot at this point. And I don't know that either company would necessarily want me to say that, maybe Nissan more than Honda, but you get a very similar package. You get a V6 that just works. You get, you know, it's kind of a low frills, we're doing this in as few variants as possible, but you know what you're getting kind of approach. And between the two of them, it would probably be tough. I think I'd rather drive the Honda, like that one, like for driving, but for like maybe all in total value and utility, it's pretty close. And especially since the Pathfinder, I think the real trick there is it's now proven itself over the past couple of years. Like when it launched, we're like, okay, it's a lot better. Are we still going to feel that way after we see some other new products come out? Because, you know, its own bar was so low. And now having seen the new Pilot, I say, okay, I still take the Nissan seriously. And I think it might even come down to the two of those. I'm not a huge fan of most of the three rows, to be honest. And I mean, being in my position, it's not a segment that I ever personally cross shop, but I think if someone came up to me today and said, hey, should I buy the Pilot? Should I buy the Highlander? Should I buy, unless they want a hybrid, unless they have some sort of like particular need that needs to be suited only by like when, you know, it has to be German. Okay. Buy yourself an Atlas, like, you know, like something like that. I almost like this, the Pilot almost kind of makes me forget that the Subaru Ascent even exists. Ooh, and just a couple of years ago, that might have been my, oh yeah, that's the new one. That's probably what you should go for. In fact, I did recommend it a couple of times when it was brand new. So, you know, that's especially with like when you look at the Ascent, you would think that that's a car where all the things that you expect from like a Highlander Adventure or a Pilot Trail Sport or the Pathfinder Rock Creek are all kind of baked in automatically because it's a Subaru, but maybe not necessarily. And the interior that you get with the Honda or the Nissan, and I can't believe I'm saying that, are probably both better. I'd certainly rather deal with the tech in either of those than the Subaru. So yeah, it's up there.
That's interesting. Okay. I looking at this fairly expansive field, I've driven the Rock Creek, the Pathfinder, and I did like it. Maybe if I really was feeling that kind of off-roady vibe, I might like the Rock Creek a touch more than the Trail Sport that you could get on the Honda Pilot. Overall, without having driven it, I tend to feel like I would probably vibe on the Pilot as well, as far as giving it, you know, at or near, you know, the top of the segment. And there's so much in here, especially when you talk about three rows. We like the Palisade, we like the Telluride. They're all around goodness. And then, of course, the Jeep Grand Cherokee, or, you know, the Grand Cherokee L. I will say this. I think if I really wanted to go into that, like, off-road vibe, I might just not, like, kind of do the, like, the trim model. I would just go over straight to the Jeep. I would just say, well, what I look for when I'm buying something. I'm just going to go ahead and get a Jeep rather than get, like, a Trail Sport Honda. So, yeah.
Well, and on top of that, too, like, we always kind of forget that it is still technically a direct competitor, but you look at, like, the Ford Explorer, and if you really care about vehicle dynamics, you want a rear-wheel drive-based chassis. So that might be your first go-to. And you can, I mean, they have the Timberline if you do want off-road.
Yeah.
And they have the sportier models, you know, you can get the ST, like, if you actually, like, you know. So, like, you have the Explorer, which is just because it, by nature of being kind of weird in the segment where it's up against so many vehicles that are not on the same kind of platform, it makes it a little strange and you kind of get a little bit of a disconnect there. But the thing about the Explorer for me, though, is I just don't know which ones I'd recommend necessarily in this case. Like, I mean, because the boring Explorers, the plain Jane Explorers that I would say most directly compete with the Pilots and Highlanders and Tellurides, et cetera, of the world, are also the ones I'm just not interested in. So while they might on paper have dynamic advantages and what have you, I just, they don't excite me at all. So.
Not to throw us off the rails or the trails, but the Explorer is a weird one for me too. Like, I do like that rear wheel drive setup, but then, and I kind of like how they look. They're so ubiquitous, you know, in Metro Detroit, but, like, to me, the interiors always they tend to fall short from what I'm looking for. You know, they're not great. I don't love Ford's infotainment. It's not the worst. It's not the best either, but, you know, to me, the Explorer is another one that does kind of get into that, like, Pilot territory where maybe it's just very, again, ubiquitous. Like, you might look at it like, hey, this is the thing I want and it has it, so I'm going to go with that. So, I mean, any other thoughts, any other adventure things from the other trims or any other parts of the Pilot that stood out to you?
I was really fascinated by that removable center seat. I thought that was going to be, because Nissan's got that gimmick with the removable console in the Pathfinder. And the nice thing about the console is it's nice and lightweight. Like, while it's kind of bulky, it's pretty easy to wrangle. The Pilot center seat, you know, when I was trying to remove it, which I did on camera, so everyone can watch me fumble around with it if you watch the video review we did of the Pilot. But when you remove it, it weighs close to 50 pounds, and I was doing it in... not maybe, like, I wasn't in hiking shoes or anything like that. I was just wearing tennis shoes, and it was muddy and slippery, and trying to get leverage on it to yank it out of the middle in order to get it into the rear storage cubby, it was a little more challenging than I think some people would tolerate for doing it on a kind of case-by-case basis. I think it's far more likely we're going to see that people pull that middle seat out and then stash it in their garage and then forget it's there when it comes time to trade the car in. So it's a nice gimmick. It's handy for people who don't want to think about whether they want an 8-seat or a 7-seat. You just buy the car that you want and then worry about the rest later. And it is kind of a bummer that you can't get that feature on Trail Sport just because the all-wheel drive system interferes in the rear with the placement of the cubby. So you can't get away with that, which is kind of a bummer. But it's one of those features where it's like, let's see if Honda's, which is kind of the more evolved version of the same plan, works better than Nissan for real world customers. I'm really looking forward to James doing a luggage cargo test and a seating test with the Pilot, especially if he can compare it directly with the Pathfinder. I think that'll be very informative just in terms of a ease of use, quality of life type thing.
That's almost old school. I remember growing up with the, like, Dodge and Chrysler and Plymouth minivans where, like, my dad would take the seat out and you stick it in the garage or something. And then it would take two or three of us to load those huge seats back in. This is before Stow & Go, or before we had Stow & Go. Let's put it that way. Cool, man. Well, that is the Pilot. I guess we'll segue over into the BMW 3 Series. This is our long-termer, the 330e that I'm still driving. It's been great in the snow. That's since we've last spoken here on this podcast. Just some really quick notes in the last probably 7 days or so. I've done exactly what I've said I've been doing with it for the last you know, recent, like this winter, which is drive in the snow, and it was good, still good in the snow, all-wheel drive. Plus those winter tires, those Nokians are still working like a champion. And I also went to the gas station, as I often do when I have a car with a relatively small fuel tank. It's, you know, I drive it down to about, you know, the range will say it signals when you have like 50 miles or fewer. So once I get into that area and it's cold out, like you don't really want to like, you know, play roulette with that. So, you know, that's, it's been about my highlights running around town. And I did take it a little bit more of a highway jaunt too. So that's it. It's, you know, like I said, it's, I think it looks good. Ours is that beautiful shade of like marina blue, interior orange, brownish orange with like kind of orange light pipes. Looks great. Steers well, brakes well. But again, it's just, you know, unless you're going to like charge it basically every day, you're going to really go through the fuel account, the gas, the fuel really quick, you know, because what I've noticed is in real world driving. So you top it off, you get say like 214 miles of range, total range, like driving home from the gas station, it'll be at 200 already. You know, it's just, it feels like anecdotally, you just burn through the miles. You know, I'll leave my house and it'll say 70 miles of range and boom, you're at like 55 miles of range and you only drove 5 miles. So, you know, it's, to me, that's frustrating. I guess, you know, if you have an in-home charging setup, you're good. And I, again, to be very aware, I'm not trying to, you know, comment on, you know, the structure of the world or all that stuff. But I mean, you basically need to have a charger in your garage and you can leave it on there for, you know, all the time it needs. And then you don't really use much gas. If you don't have that, well, you have, you know, a 3 Series with a pretty small gas tank is what you have. So, you know, that's my mini review of it. Yeah, I don't know. I do like it. It's a very likable car.
Well, it's interesting. I think we've hit a point where we're looking back at how plugins have developed over the past, you know, 5-10 years. And it kind of looks to me that the industry almost chose all the wrong platforms for plugins. Because they kind of built them around like the smaller cars first, the city cars and stuff, which makes sense because we saw a lot of them from manufacturers that have a large presence in Europe where they have the emissions regulations and a lot of the city centers lock you out if you can't drive in an EV mode. So effectively, like you can't drive your car in the center of Madrid unless it's a hybrid or an electric car. So gearing it for people who needed small cars like that made a lot of sense. And so the 330e being a compact by European standards, or at least previous European standards, makes sense as like one of the cars that it would have launched with. And RS60 T8 now Recharge that we had as the long-term car made sense in that context. But in America, those are like the worst possible candidates for plugins because they're going to be owned by people who don't have space for the most part. Where you look at, you know, like missed opportunities in pickup trucks and SUVs where not only was there plenty of room for a big fat battery, plenty of weight that was already accounted for, so nobody would have cared about a little extra heft, and people who have space to park and plug in a vehicle, but also need the range you get from a gasoline engine. So I feel like all the pickup makers just pretty much dropped the ball or never picked it up to begin with, because plug-ins would work beautifully for so many people in the middle of nowhere. Because if you're just running quick errands, either around your own farm or just around town, you could plug in for that, use nothing but electricity for your day to day. But then when you actually have to make a long haul run somewhere, you have gasoline or diesel, if they'd ever gotten around to the idea of a plug-in hybrid diesel in the United States. So it really feels like we've missed the boat on that. And I think it shows up a lot with cars like this, where like you look at commutes and the ability to plug in or not, because if you cannot plug in and you commute with your car every day, a plug-in hybrid is basically useless and you're just spending extra money. And why? So I don't know. I love plug-in hybrids. I love the formula. I just feel like we missed the opportunity to make the best of them here. And it's kind of a shame.
Yeah, no, that's, I see what you're saying. And it's a challenge, you know, different plug-in hybrids, given how they've been marketed and how like their specific usability with their range have succeeded. They have cut through the clutter. Like I thought the Chevy Volt did a great job, but the big difference is it had 30 miles of range, which was a very usable 30 miles of range, whereas, you know, the 3 Series is 20, you know, and 20 just goes quick. So, yeah, I mean, to be the sweet spot for a plug-in hybrid would have to be more like 50-ish. And then you start to look at, like, it's exceedingly rare where you talk about, like, fast charging. I know that came up, like, yesterday in our Slack channel about a plug-in that offers that. It's just, it's rare because you need the battery tech to be there. And you don't generally see that kind of battery tech in a plug-in hybrid. It's all in the all-electrics. So, you know, these are going to, I think, they're part of the transition. You know, I think at the time, you know, even a couple of years ago, we talked about the air quotes transition to full electric, and everybody's kind of like, well, whatever, these are pretty good, or all electric's already going to be here. But, like, I mean, not to be cliched, but it is a journey, you know, and it's like we got some of these things that are, you know, a little like the execution and the usability maybe isn't quite what we would have wanted after testing them. So, yeah. That's the 330E, I would almost say my weekly audio journal on it at this point. So let's talk about some other new stuff. Mazda CX-90, this replaces the CX-9. It's 3-row. You can get, it will come as a plug-in hybrid. Speaking of, I think this thing looks awesome. This is, you know, you talk about things that might give the Pilot a run for its money. I mean, this is a pretty big 3-row crossover, but you know, it's out there. So, I mean, initial impressions are, I'm very excited to drive this thing. I think it looks like it's going to be a step up over the CX-9. Powertrains are pretty impressive, as far as like the ratings, things like that. So yeah, I think this is going to be good. And Mazda interiors, have not let me down in the last few years. So, you know, I think this is a sweet spot for them. It's a large, stylish, you know, 3-row SUV, undoubtedly will have a good interior. And, you know, I don't know if it really needs that Mazda sportiness, because I don't know if you want a sporty vibe in your SUV, but Mazda does a good job of making these things among the best to drive, usually the best to drive in their segments. So I'm optimistic on this one.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I mean, I'm a not so secret Mazda fanboy. So I was kind of predisposed to like this thing, but at the same time, I mean, I was over here literally like covering the badge on the front, looking at it. You could tell me that was like a lifted Jaguar wagon and I'd believe you. That is a good looking car. I'm really impressed by it. I'm excited, okay. Genuinely excited. I think it looks really good. I'm happy to see Mazda doing some kind of mainstream hybrid stuff here, not just the we're going to do weird little things with rotaries and batteries that may or may not work right. But this looks legit to me. It'll be interesting to see. The interiors kind of made a good leap forward with the last generation and a half of Mazdas, and I think they probably still have a little more to go with that. But the photos of the interior of this look really promising. So yeah, my hopes are high. The bar is going to be high too. So let's hope they can clear it, because it's very promising.
At first I thought you were crazy. I'm like, this does not look like a Jaguar. If anything, it looks a bit like the Pilot. But then I looked at it, I'm like, okay, I can see the silhouette. I can see a little bit. There's a little bit of F pace in there.
Yeah.
If you want to see it, let's put it that yeah. Put it that way. You yeah, gotta really want to see it. Let's put it that way. yeah. How do you feel about the Mazda naming scheme? Like 90, 60, does it work for you? Or do you think they're getting confusing? Doesn't matter.
Well, everybody's doing something weird right now, like whether it's to account for electrification or whatever. And by the time we get used to all these kind of goofy naming conventions, they're going to be obsolete anyway, because they're just going to go back to whatever they were doing before. I don't really like Mazda hasn't really done a lot marketing wise so far to differentiate the base numbers versus the 10 numbers, whatever you want to call them. So I think it's confusing and pointless, but I don't know. I don't, there's probably a reason I'm not in marketing. So probably more than one, but it's an approach. And it's like I said, for the next couple of years, just don't get married to any branding, I think is probably the key takeaway. Cause you look at, you know, like Volkswagen with ID, that's all going to go away. Like all of the stuff is going to go away as things just kind of become whatever the next electrified version of them happens to be, because then they can just go back to calling it whatever it was and it won't matter. But yeah, this is a mess. It's not quite an infinity mess, but it's dangerously close to being an infinity mess.
Yeah, no, I hear you. That's, you know, you really, when you start messing with your, like, literally your make model, like, what are you doing here? And that's where I think some brands, you know, like Lincoln has done a great job. They realized they were on the wrong path and they quickly dipped back into their heritage and found some good names and they're okay. I mean, they're maybe not the most trend setting, but I mean, you know, everybody knows what a Navigator is, you know, and an Aviator. That's, they're to me the most like glaring example of a brand that realized they were doing something sideways, pumped the brakes and, you know, figured it out. It's not as easy for everybody else because not everybody has 110 years of historic names they could go at. Not everybody wants to do that, you know, but I don't know. I think it's going to work okay for Mazda, mainly because for me, Mazda is the brand. They don't have a huge lineup like Chevy or somebody. Yeah. So it's like they can tweak it a little bit. Whereas Infiniti, you know, for example, does not have that strong of an overall brand. So then when you mess with what the actual vehicles are, I think you really start to lose people. So,
yeah.
And plus they keep changing it every few years.
Yes. I mean, and at least Mazda's leading into their heritage with this, like the whole like whatever X. So, the, you know, like the going back to the RX days when it was, you know, rotary experimental and MX and CX, like all of that at least has precedent within their branding. It's just the numbers used to be very simple. And now they're complicated, but in a way that seems like it shouldn't be, but instead it still is. And I, like, if I can't easily in like an elevator pitch articulate the differences, then I feel like the differences aren't worth denoting with a different model name. But I mean, I understand that Mazda's in, this is more of a product issue for them than it is an actual branding issue, just because they're trying to find their new lane and they're going to have overlap in the meantime. So, you know, it'll be less confusing once there's only one lineup to worry about, but how long it takes to get there, who really knows?
Yeah, no, that's true. Cool. So let's move on to the Genesis X. Genesis is a brand that I think, well, you know what? I can't say that. The GV60, the 70, like their brands, their names get a little confusing too, but everybody seems to like their cars. And now they're talking about building the Genesis X, which is like, I can't believe I'm saying this, a Bentley Continental competitor. So they say, this is a report we reported on this week. I don't think anybody has had anything bad to say about the Genesis X once we have seen it to 2+2. It's gorgeous. Looks fairly realistic. Like they did a really good job of, you know, giving it like a concept-y vibe, but like it's reasonable. I imagine they'd have to do some stuff with the lights and whatnot. And there's some real running gear on it too. I'm a little torn. I don't know if they need the distraction of doing this. You know, like I think we raised this question with like the Cadillac Celestiq, like what are they doing, man? But yeah. I mean, you know, Genesis is trying to build its brand and sometimes you got to take a big swing. So this is a great looking car. If they want to build it, more power to them. I guess that's where I land.
Yeah, I'm kind of in that boat. I mean, if they can afford to do it, they can afford to lose money on it. Hey, whatever, go nuts. And it's we're in kind of a weird place with all those right now too. We've got the Cadillac that you mentioned. Lincoln has that L100, the Century concept, which is interesting, but feels far less real than any of the others, mostly just because of like the fact that it's not real yet. But I mean, we could have said that about the Genesis until just a few days ago too. So, you know, that's kind of where we are. Honestly, Genesis hasn't missed on a concept in years. I feel like ever since the Ioniq 5, like every concept they've shown since then has been great. And between this and the Envision 74, which I don't think there's a car enthusiast on earth who doesn't want to see that built.
Yeah.
It's like, it's really cool seeing some of these from them. And if they can afford it and if they can sway a little interest with it, it's interesting to me that, like, you know, we keep saying it, like customers want SUVs, but all the concept cars that we've been talking about for the most part have been coupes and convertibles, but they've been of SUV scale. So clearly, like, it's the grandiosity that we're attracted to. We all kind of have that in common. Like, we want it to be big and splashy, but like, it's interesting too that like these designers are like, no, like we know what an elegant, beautiful concept looks like, and it's not tall boxes with five doors, you know, like it's lean, mean, and large. And it's a weird combination when you think of it. They kind of seem a little antithetical, but it works.
Yeah. Speaking of the Envision 74, man, that is something that I would definitely like to see them bring to production. That would be actually, if I could pick a concept, that would be the single concept I'd like to see brought into production.
Easily. That thing is fantastic.
Cool. Can we spend some money? Looks like we've kind of ripped through the show. Let's do it. All right. So this is a good one. This is from Chase in Texas. Hey, everybody. Looking to get a new-to-me car in the next few months. Back in 2017, I leased a 2017 Giulia. Alfa Romeo Giulia. Sounds good. And it changed what I thought I wanted in cars, both in terms of having a driver's car and in terms of driving like a loaner, a lease vehicle. So that, I don't know, that's kind of interesting. When you start off an email like that, like, well, okay, I like it. So here's some of the criteria. I'll kind of whip through this. It'll be a daily driver. Daily commute is super short, less than 30 minutes, but does like to take 3 to 5 hour long road trips to see family. Doesn't have a home charger, but could be talked into a plug if, you know, the car was, you know, would work. Here are the must-haves. Sedan, four doors. Rear seats need to have a rear-facing baby seat. It won't be the primary baby mover, but it does need to have that option. Fun to drive, as close to an Alfa as possible. Must-have safety is a backup camera. Low enough mileage to hang on for at least another 50,000 plus miles. And Bluetooth, more reliable than a 2017 Alfa Romeo Giulia. I was trying to make a joke there, and I couldn't quite get the name of the car company out of there. So I guess that's karma punishing me. But I mean, to be fair, a 2017 Giulia, not the most reliable thing on earth. I think we can work on something. Set you up right here. Strongly want paddle shifters, remote start, heated seats. Nice to have Android Auto, and aiming for at least 2018 or newer. Looking for no more than 35,000 miles on the clock. That's it. Thank you for writing, Chase. Appreciate it. This is a good one. Couple things right off the top. I'll throw some in and we can kind of bat this back and forth. I was thinking Cadillac when I saw this. I know you own a CT4 Blackwing. You're not going to get that for this kind of money, but you could get a CT4, usually with all-wheel drive, for in this price range. Some of them actually quite below it. And also, I went with the CT5. I'm looking at one here. Let's see, where did it go? There it is. You know, this one, CT5, it has the turbo four cylinder. You get a pretty good size back seat with the CT5. So I think the car seat will get in there pretty reasonably well. Again, the twin scroll turbocharged four cylinder. The one I'm looking at has a really nice satin steel metallic, color scheme here. Heated seats are on it, 9-speaker premium audio. I'm just reading from the listing at this point, but this has a lot of what you want. So, and it does have Bluetooth, heated seats as well. So, I mean, maybe you don't necessarily want this one, but it's $35,995, the low price. Seems to be like literally straight out of central casting. This or something like it, I think would work. Let's put it that way. So I would look at those two as far as something that is like an Alfa Romeo Giulia, something that's passionate, that's fun to drive, that looks great. It's not going to be everybody's flavor of brandy, but to me, when I look at like something close to the Giulia, I tend to think the CT4 and 5 really fall into that same kind of bucket. So those would be my like sort of two initial choices. You know, it's basically that line from Mad Men, what size Cadillac do you take? You know, that's kind of where I would fall.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, Cadillac is going to be my go-to for this. And I think, I mean, realistically, you could probably, it's tough. Like 2-3 years ago, before pricing went crazy, you could have gotten into a used ATS-V automatic for $35,000 without much work. That would have been almost a gimme. I'm not sure that's true anymore, and that's kind of a shame. I did look, it looks like both the ATS and CT4 will fit rear-facing child seats. So in either case, I mean, it's the same car effectively. So either of those would work. If you do need more space, the CT5 is a good choice. I also like the idea of, well, again, the $35,000 thing kind of becomes a problem, but in like an older Chevy SS, because they're a little bit bigger, that leans toward midsize, where the CT4 ATS lead toward subcompact, really. But the price is what gets you, because again, like a couple years ago, you could have found an SS for $35,000 no problem. Right now, I don't know if that's true anymore. But yeah, the pricing, especially with everything being as crazy as it is, makes it tricky. The only other thing I can think of, I mean, off the top of my head, that the Volvo that we had, if you got it with the I forget what the performance package was called on that, there was a suspension option that we didn't have because we had the inscription model that didn't have the sport stuff. It's a heavier car, but for one that's a little heftier, it's certainly handled quite well, especially if you're getting the T8/recharge powertrain. You're getting plenty of power, that's for sure. And the center of gravity is nice and low because of the battery, which kind of improves the handling a bit. So, I mean, it's not going to carve corners the way an ATS or ATS-V or CT4 or CT4-V will, but they're still quite competent handlers. And, I mean, we were just talking about plug-in hybrids earlier. If you're in a position to take advantage of that, it's kind of a nice little thing just to have as a bonus. So that's tricky. It's the price, I think, that's going to be the real compromise here, because that locks you out of a lot of the certified pre-owned luxury options that would be kind of a gimme in this situation, I feel like. But that said, pricing is kind of starting to chill out a little bit. Maybe in the next 6-8 months, it'll be a bit more realistic to get some of the used items that we were discussing in this price range. But yeah, this is like that. Clearly, we were joking yesterday when we first saw this, because that must be more reliable than a 2017 Alfa Romeo Giulia thing. I mean, that's a low bar. It's sorry, Alfa, but it is. And like, so we were like, oh, this is going to be a breeze. But then, you know, once you start to figure in the pricing and the handling constraints, it actually becomes a little trickier. So this was a tougher mental exercise than I expected. So thank you, Chase, for giving us a little something to chew on.
Yeah, the price and the mileage, those two constraints get a little tough. Like I was thinking, because I do like the 3 Series, and I probably wouldn't say go with a plug-in hybrid. It's not really in the range anyway. But even just looking at like a 2020 or 2021 3 Series, you know, you're either like the one I found one here that's like 63,000 miles for about 27 grand. I mean, you know, it's literally, you really got to kind of like, you know, the scales go up or down. It's tough to get that one that is right in that, like, you know, the right mileage range. I mean, that's obviously something if you can find the, you know, one where the numbers work for you. I mean, a 2-3-year-old 3 Series would be a great thing. The SS, I'm like, I wonder how many more years we could keep dropping that onto the podcast. It's like, it's getting to be a vintage thing. The ones out there that I'm seeing, because, you know, when you say it, I gotta go trolling for an old SS, right? The ones that have the lower miles are more like maybe a 2017. I didn't realize that car lived that long. I thought it was done by that point. But you're looking at $46,000 for a car with 41,000 miles on it. And I mean, I'm even seeing one with 63,000 miles on it for 46. So, you know, and those I would imagine are fairly hard miles, you know. And the other thing with the SS is I feel like it's going to kind of become a trivia question. I liked it when I drove it. It was a lot of fun. You know, it is what it is. I think another option too would be to take a look at, see if you can find like maybe a somewhat gently used Charger or a Hemi powered 300 from a few years ago. I think that would probably, those do tend to fall in the right price range. If you're into, you know, obviously trying something domestic, those, you know, that would work. It would literally be like a poorer version of the Cadillac. Charger's not for everybody though. You know, it's, you know, again, the interior is, even the newer ones, the interiors are a little, you know, not what you're going to get from a Cadillac or even an Alfa. So, yeah, I mean, that's, I have my two, and then you can kind of talk about fun sports sedans, you know, which way you want to go. I mean, you could probably get a car seat in a Challenger. It's a huge back seat, but I don't think I'd probably tell you to go down that road. Yeah. I mean, maybe look at even like a lightly used, you know, Jaguar, you know, but again, I don't, when you're talking about Alfa Romeo reliability, maybe Jaguar, the bar is a little higher, but I don't know. When you're talking about a used Jaguar sedan, XE wasn't that much fun to drive, you know, XF was, you know, that type of thing. But I mean, just trying to think of those like brands that blend the passion with some level of sportiness, luxurious, and of course, practicality. Cadillac is one that does tend to come out pretty well. Lexus did it well for a while, but I think their design is even more polarizing than Cadillac's. So, you know, yeah, I think that's all I got on this front.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And I was just thinking, like, because you mentioned the Mopar options, and I would probably steer you toward if you want to look at a Charger or a 300, try and find one of the ones that has a multi-mode suspension of some kind, because the fixed suspension cars, the scat packs especially, can be a bit rough for family deal. Like, they might be good for corner carving on your own, but they're a bit harsh for everyday driving. But if you can find one of the older SRT models that has the two-mode suspension, or one of the newer models that has the multi-mode suspension, even the old two mode goes from like soft and comfortable to like too uncomfortable for daily driving. So it does have very discernible difference in suspension feel. So it really changes the character of the car completely. And I know the Chargers, it's big, it's heavy, it has a reputation for just not being as tight or buttoned down as the Chevy SS and the old Pontiac G8. But that doesn't mean they're bad. They're just, it's different. And I mean, I owned a Challenger for a couple of years and bought the CT4V Blackwing. So, you know, I was ready for something smaller, and maybe that's what you want to, but don't sleep on the Mopars just because you think they're too big. They are actually surprisingly competent to drive.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like I said, I'm an owner of an 06 Charger, looking to probably get rid of it, but it handles well is not the right way to take it, but it's a very drivable car. You know, it's a predictable, you know, large car that, you know, you can, you know, understand its dynamics. Let me put it that way. And not every, you know, full-size sedan or even mid-size sedan offers you that sort of predictability. So they are good daily drivers, especially, you know, if you, you know, enjoy that muscle car vibe. So yeah, I think, Chase, let us know where you land. Good luck. Maybe you'll come up with something totally different. That's great. Good luck to you. Got a winter beer, Byron?
Oh, I'm out of my key winter beer season, because most of the ones I like are the holiday stuff. So like the Christmas sales and things like that. I'm ready for spring. I'm waiting for the spring stuff to show up at the liquor store. That's my sign that the season's changing.
Cool. Cold Snap by, I think it's Sam Adams, is pretty good. That one you're going to start to see in a few weeks, I think, if it's not already there. I've literally, because we've been shoveling snow again, Labatt Blue Lights, drop them in the snow. These are cans, so the aluminum is great. Put them in the snow. Yeah. The ones that I've been drinking have Red Wings logos on them. So, you know, definitely a Michigan thing right here. And they've been getting me through. You know, it's February 1st. Couple months either way, I think it'll be, you know, you're going to get into somewhere where it's pretty warm. So I think we're on the other side of winter, knock on wood. The path is not clear to get out of it, but you can see more like the end zone. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, once you tick over into February, you're on the right side of that pivot point, I think. So yeah.
I think I'm going to try to golf in February. That was my like stretch goal, because usually you get a day where it's like 55 and sunny. People are wearing shorts. It's not that cold, just because what have we been up against? Yeah. The courses are usually a mess. So we'll see. Definitely, you can easily golf in March around here. It's not that big of a deal. But I was like, maybe I could try to get out in February. It depends on if the snow melts. A lot of things have to go into, you know, the dominoes have to fall. So, all right. If you enjoy the show, please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get the show. Send us your Spend My Monies. That's podcast@autoblog.com. Be safe out there. We will see you next week.